Russell Wilson is taking the Steelers offense to places it hasn't been since Ben Roethlisberger was here. I don't know where this goes. I tend to think it's going to get better, although so will the competition. However, Wilson hadn't played a real competitive snap of football in 10 months. I mean, he took a couple, you know, felt like ceremonial snaps in the preseason, but hadn't really played in 10 months. And it showed when he started out against the Jets. But that quickly turned around. And after the first four series of that game or so, he's cooking, right? I think I had the numbers yesterday. Something like 34 of 49. I'll get the numbers here, limits. I don't want to mislead anybody. But we've all watched, right, with our own two eyes here. He's been unbelievable. And the fact, and here's the point about this, is that coaches love to tell people how complicated football is and what we don't see as fans or media or whatever. Here's a very simple concept. If the other guys have to respect the fact that you can throw it over their heads, then they have to deploy resources to that effect. And that leaves less closer to the line of scrimmage, stopping run games and short passes. That's just common sense. And that's what's happening with Russell Wilson. Ben's later years, the past 3 years since then, 2 years, whatever it's been, nobody respected the idea that the Steelers could beat them over the top. And that just changes everything about the way that you play defense, really in the most simplistic form imaginable. It's not that complicated. You and I could go out limits and play, you know, a 4-on-4 football game, flag football or whatever. And if your guy, if I don't think that your guy can throw it over my head, I'm going to play pass coverage a different way. I'm going to move up and be able to cheat more. It's just very, very obvious. And a huge reason why the Steelers offense has been a historical franchise embarrassment for a number of years now. And that's changing with Russell Wilson. And that's very obvious. Since those first handful of series against the Jets, he's 34 of 49, 523 yards, 3 touchdowns, no picks, and a passer rating of 124.8. And I would argue that the other night when he went 20 of 28, it could have been much better. Najee dropped a ball. Van Jefferson didn't stop when he should have in the end zone. That's a touchdown. George Pickens was a touchdown, not once, but twice. Once Broderick Jones with the face mask, when Wilson was already on the perimeter, would have made that play anyway. So you can't argue that, oh, that play wouldn't happen because the face mask kept the guy from getting Russell Wilson. If you look at that play carefully, it really had nothing to do with the outcome of the play. Then there was the George Pickens not able to get both feet down on another touchdown pass. Then there was a 50-50 ball down the sidelines to Scotty Miller that could have easily and maybe should have been caught. I mean, there's a lot. We could be talking about a guy who's 40 of 49 for 650 and a passer rating of 130 or 40, whatever. You get the point. The question is, where does it go from here? Everybody's got the tape now. Russell Wilson appears to be back. He appears capable of inflicting damage. And I don't really care. You know, some people I heard yesterday talking about the point total from that game the other day. Well, really, if you, you know, the punt return, really you only had 19 points of offense. Analyze the game a little bit deeper, I would say. And first, look at how quickly you're getting into the red zone. That's step number one. How efficiently and quickly and explosively can we move the ball up and down the field? I'll worry about the red zone later. This is a brave new world in and of itself to be moving the ball up and down the field at will, seemingly. And then, yeah, things got screwed up in the red zone because of some player malfunction. Okay. I'd rather have to correct player malfunction than having a elementary school scheme that the whole NFL is laughing at where you never score or even move the ball early in games. And that's what you were stuck with. Whereas the other night, for the first time that I can remember, the Steelers came out on their opening drive and had another team just completely on their heels. And that's the scripted thing. That's just, we're going to have about 8 different looks. We're going to hurry it up. We're going to be efficient and explosive and powerful. And we're going to put them on their heels right from the start. And that's what they did. The Giants had to call timeout in the middle of that opening drive. They did the same thing on the second drive. Yeah, they should have been up 14-0. Player malfunction. You know, that to me, I can live with that because I know there's more. I know there was more there. I'm not worried about the quarterback. I'm not worried about the scheme. Broderick Jones, I'm a little worried about, but that's beside the point for now. So the schedule stiffens. We all understand that. Big Ben on his podcast, Footballin', weighed in on that. Weighed in on what he thinks of this new offense with Russell Wilson and where it's going from here. Limits, are you there?
Yeah, you wanted Ben on Cooper Kupp or Russ? I don't.
If we have to switch to that, that's not a problem. Go ahead with Cooper Kupp.
Yeah, here's Ben talking about
a big issue to you.
Cooper Kupp.
I mean, it would be a dream come true, but I don't think there's any. I don't think it's realistic, to be honest, because you're not gonna. And I just talked about with DeAndre, you're not gonna bring a number one in to this situation, right? I don't think Cooper Kupp would want to come here. You look at, he's only played 3 games, but through 3 games, 23 catches, almost 200 yards, 2 touchdowns through 3 games. Right now, we've played 8, and he would be number 4 on our team in receiving just, in less than half the games. So you put him in it just shows that, George Pickens got 35 receptions. He's only 12 behind in less, he doesn't want to come here and catch the ball 3 to 4 times a game. Be targeted 5, that's not what he wants to do. I think he would be huge because how you can move Cooper Kupp around. You could put him in the slot. You could put him outside. I think that's a dream come true, but I don't think Cooper would want to come here, and I don't think it's going to happen. I think your best chance to get a receiver here is to go find either an aging number one or a number one that's on a team that isn't any good that wants to get out and make a run, or you go get a really good number two that's ready to move, that isn't on a good team either, that wants to come be a great number two here.
That's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think the Cooper Kupp thing is probably done anyway because the Rams are actually in it. But man, I don't know that I agree that in coming here, if it was just 4 catches a game, that there would be some sort of problem. Like what's wrong with that? That's A. And then B, the Steelers actually threw the ball more than they ran it for most of the game the other day. Was that even the case with the final numbers? We were well into the fourth quarter and they had thrown it more than they ran it. And again, when we're projecting forward, I think we might see more of that. Even though Najee was having a great game, they were throwing it more than running it, Limits.
Yeah, they were. And I mean, that was the success of just the balanced approach, balanced offense. And I mean, the last time we've seen a play action offense be able to work like this was Ben. And with Le'Veon and AB, we saw how well it works. Obviously, the personnel is not as good, but it still can be effective if schemed open. And Arthur Smith is scheming guys open previously than what we saw even a couple weeks ago with Justin Fields.
Ben's other take that I was referring to was about how the schedule is going to stiffen and, those will be the real tests. That's a well-taken point, Although I don't think that these two defenses are all that bad, honestly. I don't think they are. I don't think the Giants or Jets are horrible defenses. Certainly they're better than Cincinnati's. You're going to have them twice. Are they better than Cleveland's? I don't know. Are they better than the Ravens? I don't know. See, to me, the schedule is going to stiffen in a big way with the quarterbacks that you're facing. I think the post-bye schedule will be more relevant to the Steelers' defense than it is to the offense, and I'm quite frankly disappointed in the Steelers' defense. I said, I think 3 games in after that Chargers game, that this might be their best defense in a long, long time. In a long time. Since 2010, maybe, I thought. I didn't see a weakness in any of the 3 elements of their defense, linebacker, secondary. some average players for sure, but I thought upgraded in a major way since last year, especially you look at inside linebacker. And that's what I was seeing. And if you're going to be in conversations with defenses like that, then you have to be, first of all, dominant against the run, like just crushing people, especially at home, I feel like. And they haven't been. You know, a Cowboys team that can't run came in here and ran. A Giants team that can't run came in here and ran. They pushed the Steelers around on their home field. The Steelers got lucky with the final point total in that game, in my opinion. So, point being, I think that the better teams on the schedule coming up, mostly that's about having better quarterbacks and offenses. What do you have next from Ben?
Ben was talking about how TJ Watt and James Harrison, every time there's a third down, Ben thinks that when it was Harrison and he was playing with him, or TJ, that one of those guys, especially Watt right now, are going to force a fumble and create a turnover on every single third down.
No.
It's one thing to get a sack and now it's fourth down, but TJ knows to search the ball. Like, TJ would rather swat the ball out of the quarterback's hands than, like, smash him into the ground. Like, he wants the turnover over the big, like, smashing sack. And sure enough, not only does he knock the ball out, but then he recovers it too. It's just what we've come to see and expect from TJ. It's every week. And I know people are like, oh, he hadn't had a sack or whatever. But literally, he can show up. It reminds me of James Harrison when James was doing his thing at the highest of levels. It's every single time I'd stay on the sideline and watch James Harrison and I watch TJ Watt. On third down, as an offensive person on the sideline, on third down, it's every play. It's like, okay, interception. Come on, we got turnover. When you watch James Harrison, you watch TJ Watt, on every third down, you're like, this might be a sack fumble. Yeah. Like, that's a crazy thing to think, but it's so true. Mm-hmm. Every single time the quarterback drops back to pass on third down, I thought James Harrison is going to come around the blind side because he was on the quarterback's left or right. He's going to dip under that tackle, and he's going to come with that big arm behind, and he's going to just get the ball out. I mean, I really expected every third down. It's the same thing with TJ. And Alex, too. I mean, Alex is doing it, too. You know, shout out to two sacks. They even flip-flop sides on one play, dude. And Alex got a sack. TJ thanked Alex on the first sack. I think Alex flushed him right into TJ. Hey, that's why they work together. Third down, we might get an interception, but we're more likely to get a TJ Watt, Alex Highsmith, but TJ Watt, sack, fumble, our ball.
Yeah.
It's an unbelievable feeling.
Yeah, that was good. And it's TJ Watt. Did you see what our friend Illuminor said from the island of misfit tackles limits?
Oh, he thinks he held his own out there.
Said TJ didn't do a damn thing, you know, other than winning the game on a strip sack, fumble recovery. He's wrong. He's wrong. Watch how TJ go back. And I went back and looked at a bunch of pass rush snaps, how, especially when it was one-on-one, he was making things happen. He was as unblockable as he ever is. And if you look at Pro Football Focus, TJ Watt got an unbelievable grade in that game, and our friend Illuminor failed. He got like a 40. Like PFF, it actually is sort of on the same scale as a grading scale in school. And last I checked limits, a 40 isn't very good in his pass blocking. TJ Watt basically destroyed him. Basically destroyed him, especially in the second half, and especially when he wasn't getting any help. Pro Football Focus is right about that. Thoughts, feelings, emotions, anything?
Yeah, anytime that you challenge TJ Watt in this type of regard, I mean, come on, you really think that you, young guy, trying to be cocky on the New York Giants of all teams, are going to be able to make a significant play? Like, TJ Watt, again, won the game, strip sack, fumble, and helped force pressure for Beanie Bishop to grab an interception. I mean, he's just got to go back into his hole and just accept the fact that he did not play a good game at all. And some people, they just want their egos to be as high as possible, and it seems like this is what the tackle wants.
Yeah, I mean, that was... What is this guy talking about? I can't get your reads here, Limits, because I have no internet. So I'm just going to go ahead with the next guest, which is Greg Ciceri. And he is the author. He's coming up next. He's the author of a book about the origins of pro football. Jerome Bettis, I believe, wrote the foreword for this book, or it might have been Franco Harris a couple of years ago wrote the foreword for this book, but Bettis and others had great things to say about it. And I think you'll be surprised at where some of this occurred and how. And we're going to have the author on next. He is the author of a book called Gridiron Legacy. And I had a chance to, out in Franklin, believe it or not, to be on a panel with him. And we were answering questions just about covering the Steelers. And of course, he was talking about his book. And Jerome Bettis had some nice things to say about this book, as did many others. Franco Harris wrote a foreword to the book and endorsements from Jerome, from Rocky Blyer, Merrill Hodge, Frenchie Fuqua. Greg, great to have you on, man. You're on the Sullivan Super Service fan hotline. We're talking circa 1903 to 1906, so I'm imagining that Ron Cook may have covered this live, but after him, you may be the best source of all of this. Tell us the most interesting thing that people would want to know from this book.
Hey, Joe, thanks for having me on. Good to talk with you again. I would say overall the most interesting thing that I discovered along this long 15-year journey back to the origin of pro football in its birth in Pittsburgh, which people don't know, even is a fact. A lot of people think it started in Canton, but the first pro player was named William Pudge Heffelfinger, an All-American from Yale in 1892, happened in Pittsburgh. So that's a big one. And kind of spoiler alert, but it's worth mentioning just to attract interest. Along the way, I discovered the first known professional championship football trophies, actually two of them, from 1900 and 1901 in an old athletic club in a Pittsburgh suburb. And I'll just kind of leave it at that. But it's kind of the holy grail of pro football. These silver cups, beautiful chalices, now on display in the Pro Football Hall of Fame in the Rotunda in Canton. So that's sort of A to Z there real quick.
So football has become America's game quite clearly. But, man, a long time ago, Greg, and you wrote about this, if you would have guessed, there's no way you would have guessed this would be true. You might have guessed instead that this wasn't going to survive over the long term, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a real struggle for these pioneers of the game. From the beginning, you know, professionalism back in those days, 1890s, early 1900s, was considered kind of unethical. You know, even Jim Thorpe was stripped of his gold medals for taking a few bucks to play pro baseball. But he ended up becoming sort of the savior of pro football when he started playing for the Canton Bulldogs in 1915, and it's slowly, you know, people wanting to see him play and all his fantastic skills led to more pro teams organizing. And a few short years later, in 1920, they organized, the 14 team owners are from around the Midwest gathered in a car dealership in Canton and formed what became the NFL. So the NFL started in 1920 in Canton, which is why the Hall of Fame is there. But pro football itself started 28 years earlier in 1892 in Pittsburgh.
That's unbelievable. We're the birthplace of pro football. We can say that, right?
Yeah. I mean, the history is hiding in plain sight. There's a memorial marker near Acrisure Stadium that marks the site, I think, or at least points to the field in the north side where the Allegheny Athletic Association played that game.
Tell us what the game was like then. You know, a lot of people say, oh, it's not tough anymore, which I always kind of laugh at because the players are like eight times the size they were back then and faster. But back then it was just you strap on a piece of leather to your head and you go out and crack people, right? What was the game like if we showed up? And again, we could read Ron's columns from 1892, but if we showed up at a game, what would it have been like, Greg?
Yeah, I scooped Ron on a lot of these stories. I don't know what he was, you know, he must have been busy doing covering, you know, the Alleghenies before they were known as the Pirates. What really inspired this is my great-grandfather's story. This is family lore. And I heard stories about what it was like for him when he was playing from my grandmother. His name was Bob Schiering, and he was from Wilmerding. And he turned out to be the greatest center of the pre-NFL era for teams initially in Pittsburgh, like Homestead. And then he went out to play and captain for the Maslin Tigers in Ohio against those Canton Bulldogs. But she would tell me, like, he never played with any pads on because he thought they slowed him down getting through the line, you know. And it was all a running game. They called them mass plays. It was mostly like rugby. It evolved out of rugby.
Yeah.
So it wasn't until 1906, after 20-some people died, players from football-related injuries in 1905, that the forward pass was legalized and sort of started to open up the game and make it safer.
The book is called Gridiron Legacy, and right there in the tease to the book, it says this. In 2007, while cleaning out his grandmother's house after her death, our friend Greg unearthed a gold mine of pro football history by way of a photo collection which had been hidden in storage for almost exactly a century. That's unbelievable. It's like these stories you see of, you know, the Hannes Wagner card or something that somebody discovers in an attic. What can you tell us about this exact moment? I mean, what were you doing? Was there a move involved where you had to move stuff out of your grandmother's house? And did you realize right when you saw some of these things what the impact would be, Greg?
Exactly. The light bulb, it was one of those storybook moments. And there might be a movie or miniseries in there that we might have written. But, she had three of his large team photos from Homestead and Maslin teams on her wall. And she, you know, Wilmerding, the house was built in 1898. So this is old, you know, an old home. But it was a beautiful home, and it was the nicest home in Wilmerding. So there was a legacy there for my great-grandfather that he turned his pro football career and reputation into becoming like the financial services guru of Wilmerding and Turtle Creek at the Schiering Agency. So that led to, you know, he was sort of the patriarch of our family. And these stories lived on through my grandmother. And when she passed away in 2007 and we cleaned out her house, to your point, that's when I found another box of smaller, you know, hundreds of beautiful, perfect images from his teams, people that he played with and against. Some of them were labeled, you know, some were not. And I got help from an old mentor, kind of Obi-Wan Kenobi figure named Bob Carroll, who lived out in North Huntington, who founded the Pro Football Researchers Association, who knew, but he was very close with Joe Horrigan at the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And when I showed Bob everything I had, he's like, man, nobody has this stuff. It's really special. You need to get out and talk with the folks in Canton. And they validated everything I had and said, hey, there's a great book and story here. And only you can do it with what you have. So I was like, okay, here we go. And it was a long and, you know, wonderful journey.
Well, again, Franco Harris with the foreword to this book, and I have a copy of it. It's a big, you know, picture book. The photos are half of it here. It's just, it's amazing. The photos, including the one on the cover, I've got it sitting right in my TV room. And I just like picking it up and looking and reading, you know, passage here, passage there. It's just great stuff. It's called Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. I highly recommend it. So do Jerome Bettis, Rocky Blyer, Frenchie Fuqua, and others. Greg, how can people get the book? What's the best way?
Yeah, thanks for asking. Signed copies are available on my site, gridironlegacy.com, and there's other great videos and info there. But for generic copies, they're available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, even in the stores and retailers everywhere, as they say. And there's also a new paperback out. The black and white, you know, smaller version, a little more affordable and portable. But the original is a wonderful coffee table and sort of man cave book. Perfect gift for the man who has everything for the holidays.
Greg, we appreciate the time. Really, I know this was a labor of love, and it was something that you spent an awful lot of time doing, and it was worth it. Thanks for coming on today.
Oh, thanks very much, Joe. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Again, the book, Gridiron Legacy. And truly, what I'm telling you out there is the photos are unbelievable of the early days of the NFL, its roots in Pittsburgh, its roots up in the Franklin area. It's really cool. It is. All right. In the meantime, limits. We have the Steelers at the bye. Have they arrived in about the place that you thought they would?
Yes. I honestly thought they'd be 7-1 at this point. The only loss that I projected was the Chargers. Thought they'd win the Dallas game and the Colts game, especially the Colts game is the one that, looking back on it, they really should not have lost. But they're around the same spot that I thought they'd be, yes. Maybe one win difference.
Yeah, and I thought this too. I did. I think I picked the Steelers to win 10 games. I'm willing to up that by a game. How about you? What was your original prediction? What do you got now?
10-7. Right now, I'm thinking 11-6 just because of how bad Cleveland is. But at the same token, is Jameis Winston going to continue what he did in the last game against Baltimore? So that gives me hesitancy.
See, I'm with Donnie Football on this whole thing. And I think Donnie's going to join us later in the show. Is he not, Wonder Twin?
Yes, we're trying to get Donnie in for a segment to preview
Friday's
big show.
How hard do we have to try? He's right in the building. He's Donnie Football. He does Donnie Football Fridays.
All he's going to do is walk down the hall, and there he is.
There shouldn't be a lot of effort involved there. He's preparing, right? He's like 10 feet from you, Donnie Football. Just go tell him. I told him yesterday. But anyway, I agree with him on Cleveland. They're suddenly a more dangerous team. Don't get me wrong. They're not very good. They're not going to make the playoffs. But without that guy, there's a new energy there. And there's still talent there. And Jameis Winston can win games for both teams, grant you. He could win it for either team. And you never know quite which one on a given play. But I can't help but notice, to me, the most amazing stat in the NFL this season is that I think it's 5 of the last 6, maybe the 6 of the last 7 games without Deshaun Watson. They've thrown for 300 yards, and he never did. It's incredible.
It's insane. All that money, Joe, just thrown into the toilet.
To say nothing of just the entire energy drag on the franchise of having that guy really as the face of your franchise. And now suddenly he's gone, basically, and there's a new energy. I could feel it, like just watching that game the other day. You could feel it emanating from the team, from the crowd, practically from the city. It's a new day in Cleveland. And Jameis Winston helps provide some of that positive energy. I don't know how good he's going to be. He's going to be Jameis Winston. He's going to be spectacular at times and horrendous at others. You know, just look at the other day. The game should have been over on a horrible, horrible throw right into Kyle Hamilton's hand. It looked like Hamilton was running the route, like a crossing route. And it was like a lob throw that Hamilton could have caught and run for a touchdown for the Browns. Thing is, he plays for the Ravens. Other thing is, he dropped it. And then Winston made a great throw. That little sequence was Jameis Winston, you know, his whole career in one little sequence. But the bottom line is they play the Browns twice. And I think that has become more of a challenge without Deshaun Watson. I do. And you have the Bengals. And here's another amazing stat. The Bengals are 0-4 at home. Did you know that, Limits?
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, they're taking a lot of trips down the Escaloosa there in Cincinnati. Do you like that one, horse?
Yeah, I think that's the greatest stadium-related, whatever you want to call it, nickname for something that there's ever been, the Escaloosa. They're 3-1 on the road and 0-4 at home. They're only -8 overall. They're still a formidable opponent. I don't care that they're sitting here at 3-5. As long as Burrow's healthy, they're tough to beat, period. So that's going to be two tough games. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not writing off Cincinnati despite the 5 losses. I feel like Cincinnati, anytime they have Joe Burrow and healthy, and I know Higgins is banged up, but still, defense not producing well. Cincinnati, anytime you play them, has a chance because of who is on the opposite side of the defensive line and Joe Burrow. So, no, those are going to be hard games. I don't care what the records are. Anytime Burrow's healthy, it will be difficult.
And then you have Washington with Jaden Daniels. They're the biggest surprise either way on the schedule. Like, if you would have told me before the season that the Jets would be 2-6 or whatever they were when the Steelers played them, you know, I would have said, I'm not surprised. You know, they're the Jets. In fact, that's the reason I picked the Steelers that week. Now that I recall, I said, the Jets is the Jets. I don't trust them. That's why I'm picking the Steelers to win this game. Even though Devontae Adams has just arrived, Rodgers at times was looking good right around then. No, I'm not picking the Jets to do anything. The most surprising team on this whole schedule is Washington being so much better than they were projected to be. So you got at Washington, home against Baltimore. It's the same with Baltimore no matter what. You know, they could have the Steelers could have Ben or Dennis Dixon or Charlie Batch. The Ravens could have, you know, Ryan Mallett or Anthony Brown or Lamar Jackson. It's Steelers Ravens, and the games are very likely to be very close. That's just what history tells me. Common sense tells me. And you got them twice, Cleveland twice, Cincinnati twice. And then you go at Philly. And suddenly made an ass of himself. They're playing better. Have you noticed that?
Yeah.
They blew out the Bengals in Cincinnati. They've won 3 in a row. They're going to win again against Jacksonville and again against Dallas. And they're going to have a really good record when they play the Steelers on December 15th, very likely fighting for a division title. Man, it looks like the Steelers are going to help decide the NFC East, doesn't it?
That's a good team. Like Philadelphia, I know they get a lot of flack on the other side of the state, and they've been trying to run Sirianni out of town for a year and a half, but they've gotten healthy. They've gotten more consistent on offense, and Saquon Barkley might be the best acquisition of maybe anybody in the offseason in free agency.
He looks like he did when he broke into the league. He looks like Barry Sanders, for God's sakes, right now. So I think, you know, I've seen some things to the effect of, well, the schedule we all thought was going to be so tough after the bye isn't so tough, is it? Yes, it is so tough, I think. You know, maybe we projected the Bengals to be, 6-2 or something, but it's the NFL. They're a -8 in point differential. They've lost some very close games, not so much last week's against the Eagles. I can't look at them as anything but a major, formidable opponent with Burrow and those receivers. And I realize they're struggling defensively. And then you have Mahomes on Christmas Day. Here's what I wonder about that, oh, limitless wonder. Are the Chiefs going to have the number one seed locked up? Like, are they going to have a lot to play for that day? And if they don't, could that work in a big way to the Steelers' advantage?
Well,
right?
Yeah, there's still going to be a lot of seed, not a lot, but still a couple games in terms of the NFL, a lot of schedule left when you play the Chiefs in what could be that final week of the AFC. But I don't think it will be decided. I think the Chiefs could decide it on Christmas Day. But let's say hypothetically you're right in that the Chiefs have clinched up the number one seed already. What are they going to do? Play backups? No Patrick Mahomes on Christmas Day? Do you think that'll go over well with Netflix?
I don't think the Chiefs care. I don't think they would sit him, though, 2 games out. NFL teams never do that. I just wonder about the mindset. You know, there's something to be said, I think, for when you are legitimately desperate for a win, which, who knows, the Steelers might be, And then when you don't need to win the game at all, I think those dynamics often play out. Do you think that the Chiefs can go? How close do you think they can get to 17-0? Would you go through their schedule for a moment with me?
Yes, I don't think they'll do it, but I mean, they have a lot of bad teams on the schedule.
Thank you, City Dweller. Let's go one by one. Are you ready?
Yes. Tampa Bay.
At home against Tampa Bay. Tampa Bay's got a pretty good passing game, although they're missing a couple of receivers, I noticed. Baker still went nuts. He's still going to chuck it around, but they're going to win at home in primetime against Tampa, right?
I think so, yes.
That's 8-0. They're going to beat the Fighting Bo Nixes at Arrowhead, right?
Yes.
That's 9-0. Here's their first loss at Buffalo on November 17th because the Bills, ever since I was the size of a little fire hydrant, have specialized in beating teams in the regular season and then losing to them in heart-wrenching, gut-splitting, eye-piercing fashion in the playoffs. This is the regular season. That's where it ends. They're going to lose in Buffalo. Do you agree with that?
I'm glad that those losses didn't hit you very hard. I couldn't tell. Yes, I think that that is the first loss of the season for Kansas City in Buffalo. And, you know, I'm starting to think that Buffalo might be able to beat Kansas City on the road in Kansas City. They're playing so well this season.
And the story we haven't talked about, which we're going to get to in a moment, they'll go into Carolina, they'll win, they'll beat Vegas, they'll win at home against the Chargers, they'll beat Cleveland, they'll probably beat, they're on the way, I think, to about a 14-3 regular season. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I'd fully agree with that. Maybe even 15-2.
The story that we haven't even gotten to yet today, and I take full blame for this. I was discombobulated when I walked in. Was Deontay Johnson to the Ravens? What do we make of this limitless wonder?
He has made his way backwards to the AFC North. How about that? Maybe he'll run his way backwards back to Baltimore. I mean, I'm kind of surprised from the Ravens' perspective that they made this trade. I don't think that they need that many more weapons because of Likely and Mark Andrews at tight end. They finally have a wide receiver in Zay Flowers. I don't think Bateman's that good. I mean, maybe they saw Bateman not be able to read the ball off his face mask looking at the sun and decided, well, we need Deontay Johnson to help us. He adds another weapon for them. I mean, there's no doubt about it. The Ravens are better today than they were 2 days ago. But how does it necessarily affect the Steelers?
It makes the Ravens better. That's how it affects the Steelers.
Yes.
I disagree with almost every syllable you just said, and I'm going to tell you why at the top of the hour. Let's deal with this. Deontay Johnson to the Ravens. Teams around the AFC have made themselves better in the pass game. Do the Steelers still need to? I want to play that Patrick Peterson clip again, if you would, Lim. It's coming up at the top of the hour before we get to the big boy. He's on at 12:30. Am I correct about that?
That's correct.
So we'll talk to him. But first, let's dive into this, a complete dive into Deontay Johnson. And yes, there was some tracking, some internet tracking. The plane from Carolina to Baltimore flew backwards. I don't know if you knew that. It was unbelievable. And then he landed in Baltimore. Were you aware of that story, that the plane actually flew backwards?
No, did not know that. I'd love to meet the pilot, though, that was able to navigate that. They should be teaching some lessons.
It was Deontay himself. He said, let's see if we can pull this off. The text line brought to you by Edgar Snyder and Associates, personal injury law firm, where they always say there's never a fee unless we get money for you. October is Fire Prevention Month. The Fan and the National Fire Sprinkler Association remind you to test your smoke alarms monthly. And the 50-minute mark on The Fan brought to you by South Hills Chrysler Jeep Dodge Route in Peters Township, celebrating 50 years. In the South Hills. All right, so top of the hour, your thoughts out there at 412-928-9370. Ben points out, let's wait on this offense until they face these teams after the bye. In light of that, even if we think it's more of a challenge defensively that these teams present after the bye, do we think the Steelers need to still upgrade like some other teams have done? Like the Baltimore Ravens just did. And do we think the Ravens even did upgrade? Or like Deontay with the Steelers, for them, it was addition by subtraction. Is this a case of subtraction by addition for the Ravens? Or does Deontay actually help them? And who else is out there for the Steelers to even get? Patrick Peterson had a thought on that. Injury report brought to you by Shenderovich, Shenderovich, and Fishman. They got your back, not your wallet. It's going to be mighty interesting to see who returns for the Steelers now with this nice long break. What's the word on Nick Herbig, the last you heard, Limitless Wonder? Because I couldn't help but notice the other day, and it would have been all we were talking about Monday, is if the Giants have a big play or win the game with TJ Watt and Alex Highsmith on the sidelines with 42 seconds left? Are you kidding me? What's happening here? I thought that Tomlin should have called timeout there. I was watching the Ravens-Browns the day before, and Stefanski was calling multiple timeouts on the Ravens' final drive to keep his pass rushers fresh. Luckily, this didn't backfire on the Steelers, but it was beyond jarring to see Watt and Highsmith on the sidelines watching the game. I don't blame them, by the way. They were obviously gassed. They know what's best for them. Why not call timeout there and get them rested? I forget my point in even bringing that up. Oh, Herbig.
Yes.
I'd like to have him around pretty soon again. You?
I agree. And Ade, how about Ade and Bad Moon Rising? Jeremiah Moon were out there for that play.
Can you imagine if they score on that play and get it? Well, they could have tied it then with a two-pointer and go on to win.
They were using the George Pickens School of Management for snap management.
Right. I guess they must have been. So, yeah, that's the injury report, is that we don't know about
Nick
Herbig.
Well, according
it's not much of a report.
According to our friend Nick Faribault from Slippery Rock, actually from Pitt, he's supposed to be back after the bye for the Washington game, as well as Zach Frazier, according to Nick's sources.
That's gigantic on both counts.